You may indeed. And are you Mr. Michael Moore?
Michael Maloney.
Michael Maloney, I'm sorry. Good morning to you, Mr. Maloney.
Good morning to you as well, Justice. I would reserve 2 minutes for you. May I please report, as I explained, my name is Michael Maloney. I represent the appellant in this case at this layer of Addisford Hauser. And ultimately, this is a case about a big driveway with some big problems. But I think a careful analysis of the facts underlying the layers of appeal involved in this case and the applicable standards should allow this court to resolve the issues that are before it today. Because this is a complex case procedurally, I have to introduce it with some explanation of the facts that we got this year. In 2008, Mr. Hauser contracted with the appellees in this case, American Paving, provide an asphalt driveway at his home in Kendrick, Nebraska. That driveway is approximately a quarter mile long, 1,440 feet. American Paving came to the property, did an inspection, and ultimately the parties reached a contract to pave that asphalt, that driveway at Mr. Hauser's home. That contract is embodied in Exhibit 6 before the trial court, and it's a fairly simple contract. It requires American Paving to provide 3 inches of asphalt compacted to maximum strength. American Paving came to the property, they performed that work, and there were no issues between the parties for a short period of time thereafter. But shortly after that time, Mr. Hauser began noticing that there were some issues in paving work that American Paving performed.
If we assume for purposes of this question that American Paving did not properly assign the errors in the county court to the district court, and we review this case for plain error, what evidence establishes that a 2-inch overlay was reasonable and necessary? Is that something we would determine on a plain error review? In other words, if there's no evidence that the remedy for breach of contract was reasonable and necessary, and can we still affirm the judgment of the county court on that issue?
Justice Wright, I appreciate the question, and I think that there's two responses to it. First, okay. Mr. Hauser contends that there was sufficient evidence in the record to prove that the damage was in terms of error. Specifically, in numerous occasions at the trial court level, Mr. Hauser testified that he went through a bidding process to obtain the bids for the repair work that would go over the looking at general construction jurisprudence in the state of Nebraska. It's apparent that that bidding process, as long as it takes place in a market setting under ordinary circumstances, is an accepted practice. And that's what Mr. Hauser testified to on several occasions. The trial court in this case, he received several bids. He chose the lowest cost of those bids. And ultimately, that 2-inch overlay was sufficient asphalt to put down at his property. And I will note that the analysis for the actual work itself is not very complex. Right? The contract itself calls for 3 inches of asphalt. Laid down 2 inches of asphalt and laid it there, because Mr. Hauser needed to get to that 3 inches to have a driveway that conforms to the contract. And that is what his repair got him in this case. So I believe, first, that that evidence in itself provides a basis upon which the trial court came and showed that it was in this case. But beyond that, I think there's also a procedural wrinkle that allows us to go further in the plain error process. As this court's aware, plain error is error that's uncomplained of at trial, that prejudice is a substantial right of the litigant, and that if it's left uncorrected, it would damage the integrity, reputation, and fairness of the process. I don't believe that American Paving has ever raised at any point in this case the issue of plain error, or has explained why any of its errors complained of were not addressed at the trial court in a sufficient.
Counsel, when the district court what standard is
Justice Kelch, another good question. I think there's two answers to that that kind of explain the procedural.
Well, what should an answer
like? In an ordinary circumstance, standard of district court sitting is established by statute in the state of Nebraska, 25-27-3. Errors appearing on the record, I take that to mean legal errors, and if you look at the contractors, specifically it says that the factual findings of the trial court should be treated as if they were appearing with it. In other words, it won't be overturned. Especially for damages is given great deference. As I said, that's ordinary circumstances. But in this case, because of the issue regarding timely, untimely filing of the statement of errors, I believe that plain error applies to take over the ordinary standard and basically direct the trial court or to direct the district court sitting at the intermediate court of appeals to be a little more strict in its treatment of happened.
Was the district court
And Judge, I will contend that I don't think, first of all, that the district court clearly explained applicable standard adopted in its decision, but assuming for a moment that it was applying it clearly added a standard, I think ultimately the district court did some of the credibility witnesses. In an ordinary appellate setting, it's not obliged to see part of the reason. Okay. So I think that perhaps it's fair to say that the district court did not give the deference due to the trial court in its assessment of the credibility and the appearance of the witnesses, and ultimately the whole interpretation of the witness that was trial in this case.
Integrate all these propositions for us. What did the district court do that was wrong?
Another good question, Justice Miller-Lerman. I think that the district court should have applied a plain error standard.
Because of the absence of specificity in the assignments of error.
That's
right. So that sets the path.
And I think.
And then what did the district court do?
I don't believe that the district court, as a starting point, explained what standard of review it was applying. Which creates the initial confusion, but beyond that, it never actually applied the elements of a plain decision.
No, the district court allowed them to amend the pleadings to set forth assignments of error that it claimed were made by the county court. So the first step was is the county court permitted an amendment to allege assignments of error, and then it didn't review for plain error, it reviewed for its standard of review, which you think is whether or not the factual findings were clearly wrong or clearly erroneous?
That's for the factual findings, Justice Wright. And I think that...
So is it okay to permit late assignments of error?
And as you'll recall from my briefing, I think that that's one of the major things that I'm asking to clarify the status of Nebraska's law on allowable.
How is anyone prejudiced when the trial court, when the intermediate appellate court, the district court, allows a filing of a statement of errors out of time?
Judge, I think the prejudice is the application of the rule itself, which doesn't call for an analysis of prejudice in the first place. Sets forth the timeline. They're supposed to be uniformly applied because of the uniform county court rule in this case. But if
you were saying, if I understand it, that the allowance of the tardy statement of errors changed the standard of review.
That's correct, Justice, and I think that if you look at the Wallen case that the district court relied on in general service here, that case doesn't itself explain the reason why a district court should be allowed to permit an appellant to a district court to file out of time. But even assuming that that's an appropriate procedure, I think, to get back to Justice Castle's question, the prejudice is in not informing the court and the parties of the stake in the appeal. And if you look at the larger body of appellate practice facing the last few years, this court has trended towards stricter enforcement rules.
Well, by the time you get to a hearing on the appeal in district court, everyone knows what the statement of errors
And Judge, I'll refer back to this court's previous cases that say that just because it's contained in the argument heading in the party doesn't mean that that's sufficient compliance with the rule. I think that either the rule means something and to allow a party to skirt that rule without good cause, which is called for by the county court that were at issue in this case, really depreciates the value of the rule.
I'm still waiting for the... Essentially, you're arguing that prejudice should be presumed. You can't show any specific prejudice, correct?
And Judge, I would say the specific prejudice looking at our facts is that our determination, our final judgment, the end to the appellate process, there's no finality for Mr. Howard as a party who's participating in it, not actively, as a starting point. But beyond that, I think that it's self-serving to say, well, gee, we can simply allow more time for him to prepare his brief. Mr. Hauser was in a position to complete the argument and be done with the case.
Well, they don't have to submit a brief to the district court, do they?
No. We don't have to in ordinary circumstances, Justice, but in this case, there was a scheduling order that did require that. A little more, perhaps, formality than actually required. In essence, Judge Rettles, our district court judge, entered a similar scheduling order that required an appeal to the Court of Appeals, and we complied with that schedule.
And Judge Rettelsdorf made the call to let the statement of errors be filed out of time.
And that's incorrect.
Thank you very much. Mr. McVeigh, good morning to you.
Good morning, Your Honor. May I proceed, Your Honor?
You may proceed.
May it please the court, my name is Jim McVeigh. I'm the attorney for American Paving Asphalt, the appellee in the case now before the court. I know the court's had an opportunity to review the transcript, the bill of exceptions, and the briefs filed in this case. So rather than address factual issues, which I expect the court has a good handle on, I'm going to address the three issues which are presented to the court in this appeal. The first of those goes to the statement of errors, which the court has already discussed. The fact of the matter is, as we all know, 6-1518 specifically provides that a statement of errors is supposed to be filed within 10 days from filing the bill of exceptions. It's undisputed that American Paving did not file the statement of errors within that 10-day time frame. But what seems to be lost at some point in this discussion is that the Uniform District Court rules specifically provide that a district court can set aside its rules under 6-1519.
For what purpose?
Well, Your Honor, the rule is quite clear. It's rather short, but it's quite clear. It shows upon a showing of good cause and to avoid injustice, a court can set aside its rules in particular instances.
What was the good cause that the district court found?
In connection with this case, Your Honor, we provided a motion to the court and also provided an affidavit in support of that motion. And that affidavit set forth the procedure that's followed in the district court, which is significantly different in some respects than that followed when somebody appeals from the district court to this court. At the district court level, there's no notice provided to a litigant.
If you don't assign errors in the district court to this court, we're not going to hear your case except for plain error.
That's correct. And this court specifically provides notice to a litigant that a bill of exceptions has been filed, and that triggers
okay.
a bunch of
okay.
time.
Okay, but you knew by March 1st that the bill of exceptions had been filed.
Your Honor, the record, I don't recall my specific representation of the affidavit. I knew at some point prior to showing up at oral argument.
And didn't file your statement of errors until the 17th of April.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So, is this a rule or is it just something to provide, you know, a requirement, but it's not simply an enforceable rule?
Well, and I agree with counsel to the extent the rules are there to be followed. That's a fact. And if a court...
Well, what was the good cause filing your statement of errors within 10 days after the bill of exception or within 10 days after the 2nd of March when you knew the bill of exceptions had been filed?
That's correct, Your Honor. Again, the reality is, had this been done properly, first of all, it would have been filed in the first 10 days, and as you pointed out, Your Honor, that once the note that information was provided to the court, and I learned that, or to me, and I learned that the statement of errors, the bill of exceptions had been filed, certainly the better course of action would have been to file the statement of errors within 10 days from March 1st. There's no doubt about it.
But you're saying there's an exception to the rule or guideline, right? And that if you show good cause, and so what was your demonstration of good cause to be permitted to file a statement of errors party?
As presented in the affidavit, which was offered in support of the motion, was the fact that I was not provided notice from the district court. And I'm not blaming the district court. They're not required to provide that notice. But the fact of the matter is that before the case was submitted to the district court on oral argument on the appeal, the proper motion was filed, an affidavit was submitted, the court had opportunity to hear that case, and the district court, at its discretion, allowed that statement of errors to be filed.
So the good cause to permit the tardy filing was that the district court didn't notify you, even though the district court didn't have an obligation to notify you.
And that's what I said out of my affidavit, Your Honor. The district and the district court understood that confusion, at least on my part, and allowed the statement of errors to be filed out of time. I think the district court has the discretion to allow for that under 1519. And I think to...
So that was just a matter of discretion that the district court found that the rationale you provided was good cause.
And that to avoid injustice as provided under 1519, that they would accept a statement of errors out of time.
Okay. So then, therefore, I think as Justice Castle suggests, on the eve of the hearing, everybody now knows this isn't going to be a plain error event. This is going to be by the statute.
That's correct, Your Honor. And that's why, as counsel indicated, that this should have been analyzed under a plain error standard. I disagree with that. Once the court accepts the statement of errors out of time and agrees to go forward on that basis, then we proceed as if the statement of errors had been filed timely, which I acknowledge was not. I think that's the issue for the statement of errors. I do agree that rules are rules.
What plain error would be on the record of this case if, in fact, you were not allowed to file your statement of errors?
Your question to counsel, Your Honor, was spot on. The fact of the matter is, even had the statement of errors not been allowed to be filed out of time, the district court should have properly reversed the decision of the trial court on plain error, since Mr. Hauser and his counsel failed to offer any evidence whatsoever as to reasonableness and necessity of damages. And you asked, one of the questions asked of counsel was the standard of review. In questions of law, the appellate court reaches a conclusion independent of the trial court. And to the extent that the plaintiffs failed to offer any evidence or sufficient evidence regarding reasonableness and necessity, that question of law would have been decided by Judge Reynoldsdorf under a plain error standard independent of what Judge Hendrick ruled on. So even under a plain error standard, it would have been appropriate for Judge Reynoldsdorf to set aside the judgment entered by the trial court and find in favor of American Paper.
Even the patchwork for some $5,000 was not, there wasn't sufficient evidence to support that?
No, and that's somewhat confusing, Your Honor. Mr. Hauser presented no experts at trial in support of any of the three bills that were issued, the $25,000 bill to Omni, the $3250 bill to Superboy, or the $5660 bill to American Asphalt Maintenance. However, Judge Reynoldsdorf disallowed two of the bills and awarded or affirmed the trial court's judgment as to the third. And the evidence offered by Mr. Hauser as all three of those billing statements was exactly the same, namely his layperson testimony. Well, I don't think so, Your Honor. The reason why is in the order itself, the district court says that based upon the testimony from Dreesen and Hauser, corroborated by other evidence, the county court could find the repairs by asphalt maintenance were reasonable and necessary. So what I think, as I read that, the district court reviewed the evidence in the record, and somehow, in some way, based on this sentence, there was distinction between the evidence offered as to the asphalt maintenance bill versus the evidence offered as to the other two. When we talk about we weigh the evidence, Your Honor, I guess I'm confused about it to the extent that the judge doesn't take the factual findings made by the trial court and reevaluate those as the way that the trial court.
That's the only clear sentence in the order, Your Honor, as to why the asphalt maintenance bill was treated differently than the other two. The district court was quite clear that Mr. Hauser failed to offer evidence in support of the bill as to
foundation and expert testimony, any evidence about reasonableness
well,
and necessity.
Well, but under the patching thing, there were photographs of the driveway that they showed that the asphalt had been detached from the...
Absolutely.
And there were potholes in there.
And as to the question of liability, had that been an issue, then in fact that would have been a determination that may have been addressed by the photo.
Well,
but this
there
is
was
an issue
a finding that there was a breach of contract. You're not disputing that.
Not at all. And the photographs clearly showed that.
But
Mr. Hauser brought in a
and
piece
could,
of asphalt.
Could the trier of fact look at those pictures and determine you had to fill those potholes in?
Absolutely. There could have been some
layperson. Could the trial court then determine that because you had several bids and you took the lowest one, that that was fair and reasonable because other people had bid on the contract and this was the lowest bid?
And that's not the... I don't believe, Your Honor, that that's the law in Nebraska.
Okay.
The law in Nebraska is that you have to
but
demonstrate...
Had somebody say this was a fair and reasonable price.
Yes.
And was necessary to bring the driveway up to standard.
Correct. And that's set forth in the Carl Anderson case and the Lang Industries case I cited in my brief.
One yes. quick question.
Sure.
I've not looked at the transcript. Was the county court's judgment that did it have specific findings or was it in the nature of a general verdict?
It was a general verdict, Your Honor. It was, I think, two sentences. The first one was and simply granted judgment in favor of the plaintiff for the $41,000. So there were not specific findings as the element requested by the plaintiff.
Thank you.
I see I'm out of time. Is there any further questions? Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have any time for rebuttal? There is no time for rebuttal. The next case of the day is In Re.